This is Allison Ryan. I was 18 when I first met Will. It was an afternoon in late August, my first week of college. I was sitting on a red couch in the first floor lobby, waiting to check my email, as we were all still years away from having access on our phones. He caught my eye and grinned from under his cap as he logged off and turned around. He had a smile that felt exceptionally generous. I remember wondering in that moment if we had already met, if he was also a drama student. We were properly introduced a few weeks later and struck up an easy friendship. He was in his fourth and final year and had these kind, light eyes that would crinkle ever so slightly as he laughed, his shoulders lifting in amusement. We fit in hasty conversations between classes, extended tentative invitations, took late-night strolls after cheap pizza and too much beer, hanging back behind the others, his hands casually finding their way to my waist, quickly dropping if anyone turned around. She didn't walk over right away, just got in line at the counter to order a dirty chai, standing with her back to me while the barista made it. I kept my eyes on my screen, but I could no longer concentrate on anything. Finally, she doctored her tea with a dash of cinnamon at the condiment station and sat down across from me. "That thing is like 1,000 years old, she said by way of greeting, with a nod at my computer. "Crime doesn't pay?" "Crime occasionally pays, but this still works, so what's the difference? It looks like it's being held together by muffin crumbs." Despite myself, I laughed out loud. "So," she said, "you're not returning my texts and you're drinking iced tea. What's happened to you?" "I don't have that much to say to ... I said. "And not that I have to explain my tea temperature to you, but it's hot outside." She shrugged. "You know I'm always cold." "I do." We looked at each other for a while. "I was surprised," she said after a pause, "that you didn't respond. That isn't like you." That, I thought, was very telling. "Just taking a page from your playbook," I said.
"Which is?"
"Radio silence to drive somebody crazy. Is it working?" She laughed, that big laugh of hers. Dirty and sexy and joyful all at once. It always made my chest hurt, like my heart was too big for my ribcage.
"I thought you were mad at me."
I drank some tea. "I'm not anything at you. But it's finally dawning on me that you aren't good for me, Catherine, so I'm just keeping to myself." She arched an eyebrow.
"And yet, here we are."
I have always had a knack for knowing the minds of dogs. Dad says it's on account of the way I come into the world, born in the open doorway of our kennel, with 22 pairs of canine eyes watching, and the barks and howls of our dogs, the first thing I ever heard. Back then, there was no clinic in the village, so the community health aide came out to our place once a month. When Mom was partway through carrying me, the aide told her to stay in bed and not tire herself out. Mom minded that advice, right up till the night I was born. 1st of March, so cold the ends of her hair froze. She went outside and crossed the dog yard, got as far as the kennel's doorway when a pain came over her. She crouched down, holding her belly, and hollered for my dad. I slid right out. Perhaps you now feel overwhelmed by the number and extent of our political obligations, if not also skeptical of their demands and feasibility. It is difficult to act on them, to judge what they require us to do, and even to recognize them in the first place. Individuals are left to decide for themselves when they have an obligation to resist injustice, how they ought to discharge that obligation, and whether they are still bound by the obligation to obey the law. Given cognitive limitations and unconscious biases, citizens may make mistakes in good faith. They may feel the weight of an obligation that does not in fact exist, and in so doing, reject what is just and legitimate. They may destabilize and divide society by engaging in unnecessary acts of resistance.